Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for joining us as we're done with the Thanksgiving weekend, moving along to Christmas, and perhaps you're looking for the ultimate stocking stuffer, or there's somebody on your Christmas list you really don't like. The 1990 Donruss is for you. Yes, we will take a look at the much maligned 1990 Donruss set in this podcast. We'll also look at the not so maligned, in fact, very respectable career of our random pull card number 28, the rated rookie, Robin Ventura. And even though I've often chided Donruss for missing the rated rookie bullseye more than often, Robin Ventura was an absolute stud coming out of college at Oklahoma State. There was no way that Donruss would miss on this guy, and they certainly didn't. He had a very productive career, first as a player, not so much as a manager, but of course the jury's still out on a guy like him, and we'll see if he bounces back after losing time as the manager of the Chicago White Sox fairly recently. But we'll talk about Ventura in just a little bit after we hear what you are talking about via our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Make sure you share our Twitter feed with your card collecting friends. Again, at Wax and Gum Stains is the handle. And we're actually going to go back a couple of podcasts to the 1990 Score podcast, our friends Baseball Card Back sending us another interesting card back, John Olerud, card number 589. And they note that Olerud is noted here as playing outfield-pitcher, which he never played either of those positions in the major leagues, correct? Olerud was strictly a first baseman, did play some designated hitter when he was in Toronto and Seattle and later in his career in Boston. But never played outfield or pitched in the major leagues, but they were going solely on what he had done at Washington State, where he was an outfielder and a pitcher. And Olerud was one of the rare exceptions. He never played a game in the minor leagues. He went straight from college to the pros. In fact, he bypassed his senior year at Washington State to get to Toronto. And in his first game, he hit his first major league hit. His first plate appearance, I should say. First time he hit with a wooden bat. That, according to the scouting report on the back of the scorecard. Now, even though Olerud never played outfielder or pitcher, pretty good guess by Score. I'm sure they figured sometime over the next what would turn out to be 16-year career of John Olerud, he would somehow eventually end up in the outfield or on the pitcher's mound, but never happened there. Always first baseman, every now and then got to be a DH, but never an outfielder or a pitcher. Now, a funny story about John Olerud, and of course, when I was a kid being a Blue Jays fan, I loved watching John Olerud. I thought he was a very underrated first baseman. And that 93 Blue Jay team was a very underrated team in terms of offense because they had, if my memory serves correct, three players who hit over, I think it was 320 that season, maybe even 330. It was Olerud, Roberto Alomar, and Paul Molitor. And they were 2-3-4 in the lineup, and they were just menaces against opposing pitching. And Olerud was one of those guys who got lost in the shuffle of the more notable power hitters. I mean, he could hit a few home runs, but he was a guy that was very, very consistent throughout his entire career, not just his early days with Toronto. But once the Blue Jays added Ricky Henderson at the trade deadline in 93, that just made the starting lineup even more powerful. And Ricky could still run the bases then. I mean, he would play in the major leagues for another, 10 years. And he certainly set the table for the hitters to knock in a lot of runs. And I remember Ricky and Olerud would play again in Seattle in, I think, 2000 or 2001. And I heard the story on Jim Rome's radio show a long time ago. It wasn't Rome who told the story. It was one of his guests who told the story. Might have been Dennis Eckersley. I don't recall who the guest was. But there was a time in Seattle when Ricky was talking to John Olerud. They were meeting in the dugout for the first time. And, of course, Olerud was wearing his helmet. And Olerud wore a helmet out on the field because when he was at Washington State, he suffered a brain aneurysm. So just as added protection, he would go out on the field and wear the helmet as opposed to a regular cloth baseball cap. So Henderson sees this. He's like, hey, you wear a helmet out in the field? And Olerud's like, yeah. He says, you know, I played with a guy in Toronto who used to do the same thing. And Olerud's like, Ricky, that was me. Really? Ricky was always on a different planet, but that just kind of underscores the rather unique perspective that Ricky Henderson had on his teammates, including one that he played with for a little while in Toronto, and John Olerud. And of course, Olerud wearing his cap out in the field, that was very well known, that he was the only guy who would go out there and wear a helmet on the field because of that brain aneurysm he suffered while in college. So there you go. Ricky Henderson, John Olerud together again. And thanks again to Baseball Card Back for sharing that very unique back of the 1990 scorecard for John Olerud. Now, we also mentioned the 1990 score set was Hammer Pants set, or in living color, as I like to call it. Joey W. sending us a tweet saying, "Nothing said early 90s to me like 91-92 Skybox. They designed the cards like the Max on Saved by the Bell." And he actually sends us a picture of Stacey King's card, which Stacey King is only about maybe an inch and a half tall on this card. And they spent a lot more time designing the backdrop to the card than actually dedicating space to Stacey King. Then again, you know, he wasn't Jordan or Pippen, so why not? I guess you need a little more background than Stacey King on his own basketball card. Yeah, 91-92 Skybox definitely had the early 90s vibe. And as we'll discuss in upcoming podcast, 90 Tops had that early 90s look. 91 Donruss had that early 90s look. You definitely had some, it's 1990 or 91 looks with some of those cards. But yeah, 91-92 Skybox, I remember collecting those because Skybox, if you recall the 90-91 set, which I think was their premier set, that was a very classy, well done, the gold borders, the dark black backgrounds. You know, they had some art elements in there too, but it was a, it kind of had a really cool jazz feel to it. Not the Utah Jazz, but, you know, kind of this really cool design to it. But yeah, 91-92, they definitely went Saved by the Bell on that design. Very nicely done. Thank you very much, Joey, for sharing that with us. Now, our last podcast, which I encourage you to listen to if you didn't get a chance to do it over the Thanksgiving weekend. I know you're busy and you're traveling, but we had a fun look back at the 90 Fleer set. And I mentioned that even though the set was way overproduced and you can get boxes for ridiculously cheap prices. In fact, Tim Murray chimed in. He said he bought a 90 Fleer wax box recently for $7. I actually saw a deal online a couple weeks ago. It was, I think, 3 wax boxes for $12, which is just ridiculously cheap. And it's unfortunate because the 90 Fleer set, as I mentioned in the podcast, I love it. It's one of my favorites because it's not only a good design, but as I mentioned in the podcast, there's a very personal connection for me because that was one pack that I bought every week. Every Sunday when my family would finish up church and go to the Albertsons across the street to pick up a few groceries, I was always buying 90 Fleer. So it was always a personal favorite of mine. And picking up on that, our friend Wax Pack 916 went out and made a Black Friday purchase from his local card shop. A $10 box. You got ripped off. No, I'm kidding. a $10 box of 90 Fleer. And I encouraged him to share his find. And he pulled quite a few decent cards out of here. David Justice. Man, I remember back then that Justice card, you could at least get $5 for it. You might get 5 cents now. Marquise Grissom, Moises Alou, Sammy Sosa, Juan Gonzalez, and Ken Griffey Jr. Great second-year card for Ken Griffey Jr. In fact, what ballpark is that in? Look, it might be Oakland. Great shot of him kind of following through on a swing. It's a pose shot. Great shot of him, those following through on a swing and at the batting cage, too, pregame. So very cool picture there of the kid. So Wax Pack 916, it was only $10, but I'm glad that you enjoyed ripping through the cards. You're probably going to have a bigger issue trying to figure out what to do with the 800 other cards you opened up there, but it's all right. Enjoy the ones that you got and see if you can pull a set together there. It's a nice set. I've always liked 90 Fleer. And I hope anybody who listened to that podcast who perhaps went to a Black Friday sale at your card shop or you went on eBay and you said, oh, what the heck? Let me get these 590 Fleer packs for $2 plus shipping. you get to rip open them and enjoy what is inside. Because even though they're not valued at much and never will be, I still think it's a very, very nice set, very well done, even all these years later. So that's what's happening on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Again, please tell your friends about the Wax Ecstatic Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains and remind them that we come to you every week, Tuesdays and Fridays, via Audio Boom and now on iTunes. And again, we are still looking for a sponsor for the program. We'd like to sell a service or product to our listeners. If you're listening to this program, chances are you know of a product or service that would benefit our listeners because, well, our listeners are just like you. So a lot of the things that you're involved in, chances are a lot of our listeners are involved in. And we are growing quite a bit, especially over the last few weeks. So if you're new to the Wax Ecstatic podcast and you think, you know what, I got to give this a spin, just direct message me and we will talk about that. We'll keep the price point low. Don't want to overflow anybody's ears with commercials. We want to keep the messaging limited, but certainly directed to our listeners. There are some production costs to Wax Ecstatic, even though it is a very fun venture for me. It does take a little bit of time and a little bit of money, so we also want to try to cover that too so that we can continue giving you the best baseball card podcast as we continue to just dive right into this big monster box of baseball cards and pour through the 1990 sets. We only have a couple more to go through. 1990 Tops, which is one of my favorites, and again, a very 1990-like, we'll discuss on Friday. But today we're going to discuss Donruss. Yes, 1990 Donruss. And what is so funny about 1990 Donruss, over the years, like I knew even back in the early 90s, 1988 Donruss was overproduced and it was a mess. And nobody ever really liked it. But, you know, over the last few years, I kind of looked back at it and said, you know what? Even though it's overproduced and there's not much star power or rookie power, it's still a decent set. Design-wise, it's still a decent set. 1990 Donruss, I've gone the exact opposite way. Where in 1990, I collected them because I was full steam ahead in the hobby by then. I was buying everything that came out. I wanted to sample every product. I wanted lots and lots and lots of every card that came out. But now I wish, yeah, I probably could have spent my money a lot better. While I have admitted that I shouldn't have given up all of the 1989 Topps cards I had once upon a time, while I shouldn't have given up the 1991 Bowman cards that I had once upon a time, 1990 Donruss, when I jettisoned those from my house probably 10 years ago when I was just getting rid of tens of thousands of cards, that one I do not miss. So to be honest, I have a very small pocket of cards to pull from, a random pull being Robin Ventura. We'll get into his career in just a little bit. But let's talk about the monstrosity that is 1990 Donruss. I put out a tweet that said 1990 Donruss is, and I just left a blank there. I wanted to see what our listeners would say. So here is a random selection of some of the responses we got. So 1990 Donruss is yuck, eek, meh, and my favorite, bespeckled. And bespeckled it certainly is. There is a rather bizarre vibe with 1990 Donruss. First of all, if you like red, you will love 1990 Donruss. Nothing is more red than 1990 Donruss. The cold corpse of Joseph Stalin was never as red as 1990 Donruss. They just had a lot of red ink hanging around Donruss in 1990 in more ways than one. They certainly had red ink after they produced approximately 40 gazillion of these cards, and they are still out there in the market. So if you like red, you'll like this set, but most people just really don't. So you've got the extremely red color to the front of the card, which is obvious in our random pull, Robin Ventura. Let's take a look at the card here. Very red. Very little room for pictures. There was a lot of border being taken up with these cards. And while 1990 Fleer took up a lot of border space, it worked because it was white, it was clean, it was classy. It had, as I mentioned in our previous podcast, kind of that all-American feel to it, kind of that wavy banner look to it. 1990 Donruss did not. This has the look of a t-shirt that you would buy in a gift shop in Times Square for $3.99. And the only reason why you bought this one is because the I Heart New York shirt was $4.99 and you didn't want to blow your budget. The 1990 Donruss card has a lot of red. It has the bespeckled look in it, as if Jackson Pollock's paint gun just blew up on the background of this card. And the way that the players' names are written at the top of the card, it looks like it should be, I don't know, Phil Donahue. You know, kind of have that TV talk show script on it. You know, it should say Oprah, you know, across the top. Not Robin Ventura or Jim DeShays or, you know, you name the player from the early 1990s, Marvell Wynn. I don't know. But it just was so tacky, just ridiculous, ridiculously tacky. Hot pants tacky. And because 1990 was a very tacky time, and like I've said, there were plenty of cards from around that era that had odd colors and designs and you know, little niches to them, 1990 Donruss just did not work. It was just an absolute mess. And I remember even as a kid, even though I was buying these and I'm looking at them, I remember thinking, you know, this kind of looks like the wrapper to a bag of Cheetos, and maybe not even Cheeto brand Cheetos, kind of like the Lance Cracker knockoff of Cheetos. I don't even know what they call them, cheese curls or cheese puffs or whatever. But I remember this exact same design was on those, I don't even want to call them chips because that's a disservice to actual potato chips. Those rather artificially flavored, colored, probably still living in your colon 26 years later, cheese puffs. It had that same look. And much like the cheese puffs from 26 years ago are still obstructing your digestive tract, the 1990 Donruss cards are still obstructing your collection. Because no matter how many times you tried to get rid of them, you still have a handful around. And if you're fortunate, the ones you still have around at least are star cards. At least you have a Robin Ventura rookie card or David Justice or Sammy Sosa, you know, Juan Gonzalez. And, you know, you had the Gonzalez error card too, where you had his picture that was frontwards and backwards. So at least you have the cards that are worth maybe 20 cents now. If you have the common cards, and there are plenty because it was a 716 card set, then you should probably find some way to utilize those cards better than taking up valuable box space somewhere in your house. So, as I mentioned, maybe stocking stuffers for the person in your family you really despise. Maybe you punch a hole in them and hang them from your Christmas tree. You know, these are the Christmas ornaments where if your cat bats at them and knocks them down and then chews them, you know, on the living room floor, you're not too upset, as opposed to that darling picture of your kid that was used in a classmate ornament. Perhaps you want to wallpaper your bathroom, you know, that area beneath your toilet right behind it. Yeah, you know, there's a place for that as well. Maybe you turn them into coasters. I don't know, target practice for that, you know, Red Ryder BB gun that you've been asking Santa for. There's many different uses for 1990 Donruss. Valuable collectibles is not one of them. So the front of the card, which again is much maligned, the color, the design, the style of text for the name, the splotches of paint on it, the limited use of the photography. Yeah, it all amounts to just one awful card. But wait, it gets better. When you flip the card over, now you have the standard Donruss design that goes all the way back to 1983. Again, with only a few moderate tweaks along the way. But there's that damn red color again. Although it's not the traffic light red that's coming back at you. No, it's the cyan red, the burnt orange red, that ugly Crayola crayon color that you never really found the right purpose for. You know, that was the one crayon in the box of 64 Crayola crayons that never needed to get sharpened because you hardly used it. And you tried to use it. You're like, oh, maybe I can color a setting sun this color. No, it looks kind of like puke. I don't want to use that color. Yeah, that's the color there. In fact, speaking of puke, this is the exact same color of the sawdust that the janitors in my elementary school used to cover up puddles of puke with. And that was never fun because sawdust and puke makes a rather sawdusty puke smell. It's not very good. So even just looking at this, you just go, ugh. So the design of the back of the card was always good. It was a standard. Donruss would continue to use that in 1991. But again, it's just that color. Orangey, red, pukey sawdust color. Good job, Donruss. So in the grand scheme of things, the 1990 Donruss set is a mess. There are too many of them out there. There's not that much star power or rookie card power. Yeah, you can find a Robin Ventura card. You can find Ken Griffey Jr.'s second card. You know, there are some notable names in here. There are some quote-unquote notable error cards, depending on if you get the error or uncorrected error. What's it matter if you get the error or uncorrected error? Because there's just so many of these out there. This is a set where I just say, stay away. Don't bother. Just save yourself the time. Now, if you're curious, maybe you're too young to remember the time when you could buy these cards. So let's say maybe you're a teenager, or you're in your early 20s and you're listening to this. And you go, oh, well, maybe I'll give it a try. Go ahead. You can open it and you can gaze at these cards much like you would a bloody traffic accident. But please, please, please don't invest any much more time or money into this. You know, if you find one or two packs that are thrown into some pack lot or some guy's selling them to you for literally a penny a pack, you will spend much more money on shipping than the actual pack. Then you might want to do it. But otherwise, stay away. It's not worth it. A lot of the other card sets from this time, I say, take a second look, give it a second chance, go ahead and open up some packs. 1990 Fleer is one of them. 1990 Bowman is one of them. I even said 89 Bowman is one of them. 89 Donruss, another one that was actually a decent set that doesn't quite get the credit that it's due. 1990 Donruss, everyone detracts it. I can't think of one person who says, you know, you should check out 1990 Donruss. That was a really cool set back then. Negative. Negative. I would much rather you spend $50 on five boxes of 1990 Tops than $5 on 10 boxes of 1990 Donruss. It's just not worth it. It is a space taker. It is a money waster. It is just an absolute mess of a card. Now, the funny thing is 91 Donruss, which we'll discuss in a few weeks, it has a lot of the same wild and crazy elements of 90 Donruss. But the big thing is that even though it still has a very early 90s, you know, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air look to it, it's not this train wreck that you see in 1990. There's a difference in 91 versus 92. We'll discuss that in a few weeks. But 1990 Donruss, forget about it. While it's easy to forget about 1990 Donruss, it is not that easy to forget about Robin Ventura, again, a guy that Donruss actually got right with the rated rookie designation back in 1990 because this guy was going to be an obvious star. He was a star at Rigetti High School in Orchid, California. No, not named after Dave Rigetti. There is actually no actual connection here. He was a star at Oklahoma State. As I mentioned, here was a guy who was a runner-up in the 87 College World Series losing to Stanford. He had an NCAA record 58-game hitting streak. This guy just owned records left and right. He was a gold medal Olympian, too, the 1988 Olympic team. 3 years at OSU, batting .428, .792 slugging percentage, .302 RBI. He is a College Baseball Hall of Famer, no doubt there. I mean, this guy just absolutely owned the college baseball scene. The White Sox selected him 10th overall in the 1988 draft. Very fast track up through the White Sox system. Made his major league debut in 1989. Doesn't really stand out. You look at his statistics, you'd think, oh, okay, maybe this guy's going to be a star. But still, even though he had a very bleh cup of coffee late in the 89 season, this guy was destined for stardom. In fact, in 1990, you didn't know that this guy was going to be a star because he batted .249, had only five home runs and 54 RBI, but really came around in 1991, his second time around the circuit, played 157 games, 23 homers, 100 RBI, batting average of 284. And that would start a very lengthy, or continue, I guess I should say, a very lengthy and productive 16-year career in the major leagues, where he batted 267, had 294 home runs, 1,182 RBI, and 1,885 base hits. Six-time Gold Glove Award winner at third base. He was also a two-time All-Star, once with the White Sox in 1992, again with the Yankees 10 years later. And he was in the Rookie of the Year running in 1990, although a distant seventh place in that race. Now, while he certainly made his name with the White Sox, his career was robbed by injuries. He injured, in fact, massively injured his right ankle in spring training in 1997, was never really the same afterwards. And if you have ever had any kind of traumatic injury to your body, be it a broken ankle, be it a dislocated shoulder. In my case, I've got spondylolisthesis in my neck. You know, I've got this arthritis in my neck, and that affects the muscles up there. It affects the nerves there, but it also affects muscles and nerves elsewhere in your body because your body's always trying to overcompensate for the injury. Same thing happened with Ventura. After he messed up his right ankle, he had left knee problems. He had shoulder problems. He was never able to quite live up to some of his early days in Chicago, but he did very well with the Mets starting in 1999. In fact, the White Sox just let him go. The White Sox thought, well, his career is done, and they let him walk, and he actually proved them wrong. He had a very productive first year with the Mets. He batted 301, 32 home runs, 120 RBI, hit the legendary Grand Slam single in the NLCS with the Atlanta Braves, where he actually hit a Grand Slam, but Todd Pratt, who was on first base, didn't see the whole play develop. He just thinks that it's an RBI single and the Mets would go on to win the game. So Pratt just bear hugs Ventura at first base. So it goes down officially as a single, an RBI single, as opposed to a Grand Slam home run. But he actually hit a lot of Grand Slams in his career. And you'd never guess it because Ventura was never the biggest player. Officially listed at 6'1", 185. You know, he wasn't this muscular beast, but boy, he could connect with the ball. 18 Grand Slams in his career. That's pretty impressive. Fifth all-time in Major League Baseball. So he had that legend continue in 1999 with the Mets, was a big part of the Mets National League pennant in 2000, where they would lose to the Yankees. And eventually he got traded to the Yankees, ironically, for another big stud from the 1990 baseball card era, David Justice. How odd is that? He would get platooned in the Yankees at third base with another big 1990 baseball card named Todd Zeal. And by then, his career started going downhill. He was used primarily as a pinch hitter or, again, as a platoon player, was traded at the deadline in 2003 to the Dodgers and wrapped up his career with LA in 2004. Then he got into broadcasting, and also he got into management. He was the manager of the White Sox from 2012 to this past season, and he had a really good debut season. In fact, he finished second to Bob Melvin in the Manager of the Year race. Of course, Melvin and the Oakland Athletics with a pretty good 2012 season. Also, the White Sox finished second to the Detroit Tigers in the AL Central, just three games behind the Tigers, an 85 and 77 season. After that, all downhill as the White Sox won only 63 games the next season. Next few seasons, they were in the low to mid-70s, and while that's really good baseball weather, not good win total for a 162-game season, so he's been relieved of his duties. But I'd be curious to see where he ends up. I'd be curious to see if he's kind of like a Terry Francona, who ironically was in the White Sox minor league system in the 1990s. I saw Francona manage the Birmingham Barons back in 95 or 96. And, you know, Francona got his break with the Phillies, but the Phillies were a mess. And then he eventually went on to Boston and later Cleveland and had a lot of success in both cities. Be curious to see if Ventura gets that chance elsewhere and if he can make the best of it, because clearly the White Sox are not a good enough team to compete not only in the Central, but even just be halfway decent right now. That's more of an organization issue not a manager issue, although I'm sure he wished he could build off of that success he had in 2012, just wasn't able to do it. So he's out there looking for work at last check. But as a baseball player, very steady career, very consistent career, despite the injuries. Again, starting in 1997, where he missed half the season with that ankle injury, but later on when he developed the knee and shoulder issues as well. Now, the one blemish to Robin Ventura's career, and this has actually become a very dark anniversary in the realms of baseball history, but one of my favorite moments, and I say this with all due respect to Robin Ventura, you know what we're talking about. August 4th, 1993, the old Arlington Stadium, Texas Rangers, Chicago White Sox, 43-year-old Nolan Ryan on the mound. Ryan beans Ventura right in the head, right off his helmet. And Ventura, if you watch the video, he starts going to first. You know, he kind of like thinks about it for half a second. And then he charges the mound. And the rest is history. The old man just beats the crap out of Ventura. And not only does he beat the crap out of him, but Ryan is not thrown out of the game. So he goes on to pitch the game with Robin Ventura's blood on his jersey. There's a little bit of Nolan Ryan's blood on there as well. But there's a rather iconic picture, actually two iconic pictures of this. One is Ryan holding Ventura in a headlock and just wailing away at him. And then there's another picture of Ryan on the mound, a little bit bloodied with Ventura's blood all over his white Texas Rangers jersey. So it was a rather infamous moment, rather memorable moment. I'm sure Ventura would like to forget it, but it is something where on every August 4th on social media, somebody will post that video and we all get a nice little chuckle out of that. And as somebody who saw Nolan Ryan in person, not only pitching at this time, because I saw him, I've told you stories about how I used to take part in color guard ceremonies at Texas Rangers spring training back in the early 90s. Not only did I see Nolan Ryan in person still dominate that big, stocky, good old Texas boy on the mound, I mean, he still put the fear of God in people, in batters, just because of his mound presence. Never mind that he was still throwing, you know, 98 miles an hour in his early 40s. But he had this great presence on the mound that just scared the living hell out of people. And not only did I get to see that, but I got to see it off the mound. I remember clear as day, he was working out one of these spring training games I went to. He's working out at the Rangers clubhouse, which at the time was adjacent to the field. It was just butt up right next to the field. So he does this workout and he decides that he's going to sign some autographs. So he goes to this gate in the fence, and the Texas Rangers media and public relations people, they get around him to protect him. They open up the gate, and of course, a line forms immediately. You know, here's Nolan Ryan signing autographs. So what Ryan would do is he would sign the autographs, and he would have his head down, and he would sign the card or magazine or baseball or, you know, whatever people brought. And he would thank people, and he would just take the next item. And he never lifted his head. He always had his head down. Well, of course, anytime you have an autograph line, you have the autograph hounds. You have the people that get an item signed, and then they go to the back of the line, and then they go through again. Well, Nolan Ryan was no dummy. The reason why he had his head down all the time, I figured this out. He was looking at the shoes of the people who were signing autographs, or who he was signing autographs for. And if he saw the same pair of shoes, he would look up and he would recognize the person. And he would say something like, "This is the last item I'm signing for you." And when Nolan Ryan looked deep into your eyes, deep into your soul, deep into your black heart, because you were going to take the second item you were getting signed and you were going to buy a table at the next card show and you were going to sell it for $30, $40, $50. When he penetrated every bone in your body with that stare and you're inches away from Nolan Ryan doing this to you, I can promise you there were people that did not get back into the line the third time. You got that second item done and you got the hell out of there. So I was able to witness this in an autograph line. Robin Ventura witnessed it the hard way. as he went face to fist with Nolan Ryan back on August 4th, 1993. So other than that rather ignominious moment in baseball history, Robin Ventura had a very good career. Not only was he a stud in college, but a very good, consistent ball player. Surprisingly, was never on a World Series winning team, but was on a team that went to the playoffs a couple of times. Of course, the Yankees and Mets and White Sox. The Mets getting to the World Series in 2000, losing to the Yankees. But this was a guy who had a very solid career and certainly nothing to be ashamed of, other than getting beaten up by Nolan Ryan. But he was also an outstanding fielder, despite the injuries, was able to play third base for a very long time and did eventually make the shift to first base later on in his career. So while Robin Ventura's career was good, 1990 Donruss, not so much. Again, don't waste your time. Don't waste your money. Again, if you're just somebody who's into curiosities, maybe you buy a pack and you're just going to look at them. But whatever you do, don't invest too much time or money. This is just one of those sets. Just forget about it. Just move on. And if you're somebody who still has a box of 1990 Donruss cards laying around that you don't know what to do, you can donate them. You can, like I said, make Christmas ornaments out of them, make really tacky Christmas gifts out of them, or you could just throw them away. You know, it's hard to throw away old baseball cards. You hate to do it, but because there's just so many 1990 Donruss out there, and they're not very well liked, they're not very good cards. You know what? We'll give you a pass on this one. It's okay. You can move on them or sell them at your next garage sale. Sell that 800 card box full of them for a dollar just to get them out of your house. It's perfectly okay. You will not be disliked because you do that. Now, in our next podcast, we're going to take a look at the 1990 top set, which for many of the same reasons that the 1990 sets that Donruss and Fleer and Bowman and everybody else put out, people don't like them. This is an overproduced set, but there's something really neat about the 1990 top set that has still, all these years later, still provides collectors with a good reason to hang on to them. You're not going to make a lot of money off of 1990 tops, but we're going to take a look at the set, especially in design. It is a rather odd looking set, but it's one that, unlike Donruss, you shouldn't throw out. In fact, this is one of those sets that maybe you take a second look at and go, you know what? Maybe I spend $10, $15, get a couple of boxes, and try to put together a complete set because there are some good cards in there. There are some interesting and unique quirks to the set, and it's one that you definitely need to give a second look at. So we will do that on Friday. Again, join us on Audio Boom or iTunes. You can find our podcast there or follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. We, of course, will send out the link for the show when we got it ready for you on Friday morning. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for tuning in once again to Wax Ecstatic.